Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about business, and one business in particular. I think it's fair to say that few American corporations have been as admired and also as vilified as Walmart. It's a company that's been criticized on a number of levels. It's been criticized for destroying competitors, particularly small ones, for creating low-paying jobs, and also for fighting efforts to organize workers. At the same time, from a purely business perspective, Walmart has been admired for its success and its growth. And it is true that very large numbers of Americans shop there, apparently attracted by low prices. The question is, why has Walmart been such a success? And larger than that, what does it mean for the American economy? Those are some of the questions that we'll try to take on this morning in this part of the show as we talk with business writer Charles Fishman. He is a senior editor at Fast Company magazine, and he is the author of a recently published book, which is entitled The Walmart Effect. The subtitle is How the World's Most Powerful Company Really Works and How It's Transforming the American Economy. It's published by the Penguin Press. Just a bit more here about our guest. He wrote a cover story for Fast Company that won some awards, and in fact, it generated the strongest reader response in the history of the magazine. He also last year won the Gerald Loeb Award, which is the highest award in business journalism, for which he had been a finalist three times. He started his career at the Washington Post. He has also been senior editor at the Orlando Sentinel and the News and Observer. He's also regularly appeared on NPR, on CNN, and Fox News. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions are welcome, as always. The only thing that we ask of people who call is just that they try to be brief in their questions and comments so that we can get in as many different people as possible and keep the program moving. Questions, however, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Mr. Fishman, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
I certainly appreciate it. I think it's a fascinating book, and I guess I have to say that, you know, doing this job that I do, I move at high speed through an awful lot of books, and every once in a while I come to one that it's very difficult to skim because the text keeps sucking you in, and I think this is one. The way that you tell the story, I think, is interesting because it is there are a lot of stories in the book. It's not merely a lot of facts, although you do glean a lot of facts by going through the text that way.
I appreciate that. I think the best way for people to understand an institution, and Walmart's really an institution, as important and as with as wide an impact as Walmart is to hear some stories about how Walmart works and what Walmart's impact is on companies, on individuals, on communities, on businesses. It's a great way to sort of capture the complexity of Walmart's impact, but also tell a story that people can enjoy and remember.
And in fact, when you use a term like the Walmart effect, which I understand it's not something that you coined, it's a phrase that has been in currency now for a while, you're talking about, in fact, something that is multifaceted. So one really is talking about effects, and it works on different levels. And as you say, it affects the way retailers operate now. It has effects on people who manufacture the products that the retailers sell. It has effects on consumers and consumer behavior, the choices they have, the choices they make. And we can try and get in some of these different areas, but that's...
Absolutely. Walmart is an extraordinary corporation and a company that there are many things you can admire about it, but what's most remarkable about it is the range of impacts it has. Walmart affects wages. Walmart affects healthcare. Walmart affects how your deodorant is packaged. Walmart affects the price of your barbecue sauce. Walmart affects the quality of bicycles and the quality of electronics you buy. And as we sort of lay out in great detail in the book, Walmart actually single-handedly reduces the inflation rate across the entire economy. And so to me, it's really important. Walmart affects pollution. Walmart affects how people in China and India and Bangladesh live their lives. And so to me, it's really important, given the range of impact of a company like that, and I actually make the argument in the book that Walmart is so powerful now that it is really a new kind of economic power, that the effects are so wide-ranging, we really need to take a step back and reassess how we think about a company this large and what its proper role in our country and in the global economy is.
Well, that's, I think, probably when one starts out talking about Walmart, it's a natural inclination to toss out a number of numbers that describe its size and power, and having to do with how rapidly it's grown, the sales, how many people it employs, how many different kinds of products it sells, how many stores, those sorts of things. And it seems to me that every time I read one of these lists, I feel that no matter what I thought I knew about how big Walmart was before, I really didn't have any idea just how big it was. And when you read some of the things that are in the introductory sections of the book, that's the way it strikes you. It's that you think, gosh, this is even bigger than I thought.
Well, let's give people a little taste.
Yeah.
Walmart sells more merchandise by St. Patrick's Day every year than Target sells all year. Walmart, one-third of the country, slightly more than one-third of the country, 100 million people a week in this country alone go to Walmart. I'm not sure 100 million people a week in this country do anything except eat and take a shower and sleep. You know, that's an incredible sort of vote on the part of the culture of the country that they are interested in what Walmart has to offer. Last year, I looked up the Walmarts around Champaign-Urbana before you guys called me, and I see that you guys have two super centers right near the center of town, and a couple more Walmarts in the immediate surrounding periphery.
And there's one that's under construction right now. So we're going to have another one. Yes, I guess among the many things I don't understand is how it is that an area this size is supposed to support all those stores, but you know, maybe that's another question.
Well, in all kinds of ways, but here's an interesting fact: if you, David, and I were to open a supercenter, which has 150 or 170,000 square feet, 4 acres under a single roof, 160,000 different items. Not 160,000 boxes of items, 160,000 different items, literally millions of items in stock, and the shelving and the display racks and the staffing and the computers. If you and I were to open one of those stores, it would be our job for a year, and we'd probably be frantic most of the year. In America alone, in the United States alone, Walmart opens 5 a week, one every single business day. So that's, that to me is astonishing. And then let's talk for a minute about the story that opens the book. Back in the early 1990s, I suspect many of your listeners will remember that deodorant used to come in a little paperboard box, just like toothpaste comes in now. You pulled your Sure or your Ban, your roll-on or whatever it was out of the box. You pitched the box in the garbage, and there was your deodorant container. And the deodorant container itself was sort of hard glass or plastic or metal. And it was already stronger than the box. And the box was really for the deodorant company. They like boxes to display lots of information. And Walmart went to the deodorant makers and said, the box takes up space on the shelves. It's a waste of cardboard. It's a waste of trees. If you go back a step, you guys have to design it and hire people to, make it look good. In some factory somewhere, people have to put the deodorant in the box, even if it's done by machine. And all people do is throw the box away. Let's get rid of the box. Let's unbox the deodorant. And if you walk into any Walmart now, and also any Eckerd or CVS or Rite Aid, whatever Walgreens, whatever chain you have, there is not a single brand of deodorant that comes in a paperboard box anymore. literally billions of dollars, and whole forests have not fallen because Walmart said, let's get rid of the box. And in the years after Walmart eliminated the box, Procter & Gamble had to get rid of 13 people who were on site in Cincinnati who did nothing but manage the cardboard box business for a big cardboard box provider to P&G. So sort of a good news and a sort of a dark side story, even in something that looks good. There's always a cost with Walmart.
Well, you know, as we said, there are so many different directions we can take this in. Let me just pick one and have you talk a little bit further. And that is the kind of, and I think probably people have heard stories like this, that Walmart is so big and it orders so much of a particular product, whether that's ketchup or pickles, for example, because you have a pickle story, or deodorant or bicycles or, you know, what it is, that Walmart is in a position to go to the manufacturer and make the proverbial offer that can't be refused because it's so big the manufacturer can hardly turn away a client like that. They may, in fact, depend on a client like that. On the other hand, Walmart, then that puts Walmart in a position that says, this is what we want and you will give it to us, and that may indeed result in savings that can be passed on to consumers. So it may be good for them, and it may be good for Walmart because they get to sell the products, but it may not be so good for the producer of the product because they may, in fact, be pushed into a corner that either loses them money or then they have to do something to manage to stay in business. And then that also trails out into other things like, well, what do they do? Does that mean that they go offshore for their production? Does that mean they just make it a product of a lesser quality so
right.
they can meet Walmart's price? And that's where this – it just seems to go on and on and on.
That is right. Yeah. That is the ripples of the Walmart effect. Do you want to talk about one of those?
Yeah, do that. Yeah.
Well, maybe a good one is not too far away. L.R. Nelson is a large lawn sprinkler company for a lawn sprinkler company. It's a large lawn sprinkler company up the road in Peoria, Illinois. And L.R. Nelson has been making lawn sprinklers in the United States for 100 years. They're kind of a classic yellow color. Anybody who actually waters their lawn at some point in their lives, whether they're paying attention or not, acquires a Nelson lawn sprinkler, and they have a As I said, they've been making them for 100 years. They have a long reputation of quality. And a lawn sprinkler isn't a high-priced product to begin with. And L.R. Nelson, about a third of L.R. Nelson's business goes to Walmart. That's where many, many lawn sprinklers are sold. And last summer, Walmart told L.R. Nelson that the lawn sprinklers were good because they were made in Peoria, right there in a factory in Peoria, and they were reasonably inexpensive. They were selling them for between $5 and $6. But the lawn sprinklers identical that Walmart could buy from its Asian suppliers were $1.97, literally $5 cheaper. And they said to L.R. Nelson, either you start making your lawn sprinklers completely in Asia, in China, or we're going to buy our lawn sprinklers from someone else who can provide these really, really cheap lawn sprinklers. And L.R. Nelson, which had been gradually moving some production and parts of production overseas to China, and then they would sometimes bring parts back and have them assembled in Peoria, they laid off all of their factory staff that made consumer products, that made consumer lawn sprinklers, and essentially stopped U.S. manufacturing, literally because Walmart ordered them to. And I think this is kind of a classic example of trying to understand the impact of Walmart. I'm not living paycheck to paycheck, but I don't think even people who are making $500 and $600 a week need a lawn sprinkler that costs $1.97 instead of one that costs $6.97. That's not a critical difference in price on a medicine or a critical food item or something. And a $6.97 sprinkler is already pretty inexpensive. But L.R. Nelson wasn't in a position to give up a third of its business on a single day by insisting to continue to make sprinklers in the United States. A third of their business was vital, and once you give up that business, then Walmart's going to its competitors, and the other competitors are going to reduce their price. There's a downward spiral. But L.R. Nelson at that point also felt like it was in a box, because even if they said we're going to keep doing what we're doing here, Walmart had said we're going to pull our business. So the L.R. Nelson people would say to you, we're losing the business one way or the other. We might as well keep our white-collar workers and our sales force in America, even if we have to move the manufacturing to Asia, and we're really sorry to lose these U.S. manufacturing jobs. But the really interesting point about the L.R. Nelson example, beyond the fact that I stumbled on those guys, and the CEO of L.R. Nelson actually told the Peoria paper that Walmart ordered him to close the factory. That kind of frankness never happens. Mm-hmm. And he obviously had a conversation with somebody, because he would never call me back to have that same conversation. But the market wasn't demanding even cheaper lawn sprinklers. There was no sort of softening of demand because $6.97 was too much, the way $60 a barrel oil is too much. And there was no flood of lawn sprinklers from somewhere that was forcing the price down from $7 to $2. This is an example where Walmart stands astride the laws of market capitalism and literally defies them. It is not a $1.97 lawn sprinkler is not part of the market, the pricing structure, supply and demand. It's simply Walmart ordering a supplier, because it has the power to do so, to provide something more cheaply. And so people often defend Walmart by saying, Walmart's just good business. They succeed because we have a market economy, people are free to make choices, and they've chosen Walmart, and Walmart does things better, and they're the victor. I would say that 20 years ago that was true. And in some arenas it's still true. But in point of fact, Walmart is so large, they dominate individual categories of merchandise. They are the largest seller of guns, the largest sellers of deodorant, and the largest sellers of bicycles. You can't imagine three more widely diverse products. But if you sell guns, deodorant, or bikes, your number one customer in America is Walmart. And so they literally reshape the laws of price and supply and demand to suit their own needs. And so to me, that's a hidden sort of Walmart effect that isn't accounted for. It's good for consumers right at the shelf, right at the moment you buy the lawn sprinkler. Who wouldn't keep a $5 bill in their wallet to get a very similar lawn sprinkler, right, at that moment? But in the long term, the question is, what is the impact of a company so powerful that it can drive suppliers overseas, where, by the way, those things are cheaper in part because there's no pollution regulations and no safety regulations and no workplace rules, and where the laws of supply and demand and market capitalism are sort of set aside and the prerogatives of a company this large end up ruling the day.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Charles Fishman. He's a business writer. He's senior editor at Fast Company magazine, has written for his magazine about Walmart, and also is the author of a recently published book that goes into the subject in greater depth. The title of his book is The Walmart Effect. It's published by Penguin Press. We do have a couple of callers here. People who are interested in calling in can do that. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have someone in Belgium, nearby, community nearby. Line number four. Hello.
Good morning. I hope I'm not the only person around that's noticed or observed this fact, but it seems to me that we have put ourselves in a problem here by depending upon a company that every place you look in the company, there's an American flag. It says, oh, America, America, America. Let's be true to the red, white, and blue. But yet at the same time, they force every product to go overseas because that's the only place you can get the prices for labor that will make these prices functioning. And when you do that, who's the first person that's going to suffer? The person who's buying the product, because they've lost a job to somebody else. Now, that other person is glad to get the job. Don't get me wrong. The folks in China need jobs, too. But we have totally destroyed our own economy by doing exactly what you're pointing out here. These people are very, very efficient, but they're efficiently ruthless to their bottom line. They make sure they make plenty of money. But do they really shop at Walmart, too?
Well, I assure you the people who work at Walmart shop at Walmart.
No, I'm talking about the owners of Walmart. I'm not talking about the people walking the aisles.
Yeah, walking the aisles. But here's the problem. You know, the finger of responsibility really needs to point back at us.
Exactly.
Because Sam Walton's insight, Sam Walton created the largest company in the history of civilization himself, from scratch. I mean, he obviously had a lot of help, but this was his idea. His insight was Americans will do a lot to save a dollar or $2, and shown a lawn sprinkler or a pair of athletic socks or tubes of toothpaste or a package of disposable diapers, if they know a place where that is 30 cents cheaper or $1.99 cheaper, they will go to that place and buy it just to save those few dollars. And we for all of our devotion to capitalism and democracy, we don't often think about the consequences of where we shop. You know, Walmart's not Halliburton. Walmart's not Lockheed Martin. Walmart is built on the dollars that ordinary Americans spend there every day. And Walmart listens to consumers very, very closely. And the most important thing they've heard for 40 years is, we will cross the street, we will cross the city, we will change our shopping habits just to save a few dollars. And so that's an interesting, there's something admirable about that in the American character, but here's a company that has taken that character trait and focused it so intensely, and now we're seeing that the consequences of always low prices are quite remarkable and not always appealing.
No, it's at the cost of our own jobs. Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the call. Something else that I think is interesting about this that you point out, that again takes us into a little bit different direction, another effect, is that the sort of ruthless dedication to low price that Walmart has has maybe tended to warp our ideas about how much things should cost. And that if you pick any kind of product, you know, for example, in the book you talk about lawnmowers and a particular company that makes lawnmowers who decided they weren't going to play the Walmart game. But if you say you'd take a lawnmower, you can make a lawnmower and a very good one and sell it for $500. And you can also make a lawnmower and sell it for $130. And there are a lot of people that are going to look at those two lawnmowers and going to say, well, they'll both cut my grass. Why should I pay $500 for this one when I can get this one for $130 that does the same thing? And in fact, they may even go to the point where they think this guy who's charging me $500 is ripping me off.
Exactly.
But the point, though, is that, well, though, really, you get what you pay for, and that the $500, you'd think that probably the $500 mower is actually better, will last longer, maybe even do a better job. But, you know, there are a lot of people who will say, but it's not, who won't understand that, who will say, well, it's ridiculous to pay $500 when I can have the $130. And as I said, it's beginning to warp people's ideas about what's an appropriate price for an item, how much I really should think about paying for something.
I think this is one of the most remarkable impacts of Walmart, which is that Walmart has literally gotten inside our brains and changed the way we think about the world. And this is a perfect example. You don't mind if I mention who the lawnmower?
Oh no! Is. I said no. I got no problem with you talking about who it is. Yes,
that's Snapper, and right. They sort of consider themselves a kind of high-end lawnmower, a Lexus or a BMW or a VW Passat compared to a Toyota Camry or a Honda Accord. And Snapper looked around at their Walmart business. 20% of their lawnmowers were being sold at Walmart. And they saw this kind of downward spiral of expectations. And they were competing. Walmart sells lawnmowers for $99. Many of those lawnmowers won't start the second summer you try and use them, the second spring you try and use them. They're almost disposable. But when you sell the lowest price Snapper lawnmower is $300. So you can buy three of the Walmart lawnmowers for the cost of the cheapest Snapper lawnmower, the cost of the cheapest VW Passat or Lexus lawnmower. And so people have kind of lost track of what the importance of quality is. We talk about the disposable society all the time, but Walmart now sells full-size color TVs, lovely, not particularly name brand, but a 20 or a 24-inch color TV for $160 or $145. Who's going to take the trouble to load that 90-pound TV into their car and try and get it fixed? It's disposable. It's so cheap. Why would I even think about paying somebody $25 to figure out what's wrong with it? And so Walmart has literally changed how we look at the price of items, how much we think things should cost. It almost makes you, as you said, sort of suspicious. Why should I pay $179 for a DVD player? What could it possibly have? Mm-hmm. But I have an interesting experience. I buy a particular kind of Timex watch that I like, and I've got four sitting on my desk waiting to be sent back to Timex, all purchased at Walmart. I'm just sort of watching how they do. They last about 8 months, 9 months. Timex fixes them for $4 or $5. You mail them back. They send you a little bill that says, please send us $4. But no wonder the watch is so cheap. It is itself disposable. But then when you go see a watch somewhere for $99 or $150, you sort of think, well, if Walmart can sell it for $32, where's the extra money going? You must be ripping me off. And even in a setting like a grocery store, a lot of the reasons that grocery stores that compete directly with Walmart price a little higher is they're paying $15, $17 an hour. Their stores have unions. Their employees have benefits. And I know I want health insurance. I'd be in tough shape with a family with no health insurance. I think almost everybody who shops at Walmart themselves wants to be paid a reasonable wage and have health insurance and some reasonable pension benefits of some kind. And yet, when we shop at Walmart, we're sort of voting for the leanest possible operation with blinders on, saying, all I care about is price. I've put aside quality for the moment, and I've even put aside what impact that has on the community I live in terms of how the people who live alongside me are treated.
We have a number of other callers. Let's go next to Bloomington, Illinois, line number one.
Hello.
Yes, hello.
I thought I would agree, especially with what the guest just mentioned about the low-quality products and those workers being paid low wages, no health care, and all the problems that he mentioned. I'm a very, I guess, liberal person, and I really want economic and social sustainability. And yet, I'm also an economics major, and the example given with the water sprinklers, I found a lot of fallacies in that guest's argument, and I'd like to point to three of them. Mm-hmm. One being globalization. I think he inherently was assuming, sort of in the argument, that this was bad, that jobs were moving, but this is economic restructuring and is probably more efficient, and that's why the global sourcing was done. But the two more important were the talking about the price going down on the sprinklers from $6 to, say, $2. That's more than a 50% drop. He mentioned that that wasn't significant. I would say that that's extremely significant, and also perhaps that leads into the argument on demand and there being no demand for that. I would argue that there is demand for that because that's why people shop at Walmart. They want to find those cheap products. That's why there's demand for 5 new Walmarts a week. So when the guest says there's no demand for the sprinklers and that there's no demand within the structure of a capitalist economy and that they're creating their own, I would think is inherently fallacious, and I'd like his comment.
All right.
Well, you raise great points, and I'm glad to have somebody who's more of an economist than I am, because I'm not much of an economist. The first point is you're right. That is globalization. Globalization, just briefly, assumes a kind of level playing field, and I would suggest to you that the difference in price between making it in Peoria and making it in Shenzhen, China, is not simply wages. It's that in China, whatever pollution regulations they have are not enforced. And so a lot of the costs of the sprinkler, the pollution that results from the manufacture and shaping of the metal and the plastic, are not, in fact, internal to the cost of the sprinkler anymore, as
they were here. Very, very good point.
Okay, so that's sort of not fair. In point of fact, given the logistics and cost of shipping to bring something as light and inexpensive as a sprinkler from China in a box, if the field is leveled in terms of those kinds of things, the wages don't actually make that much difference because of the efficiencies of getting things to market and because American factories can be more efficient and a little more capital intensive than overseas factories. The question of supply and demand is an interesting one. It sounds like, if I can extrapolate, you're making the argument that the seller should be able to impose his or her price on the manufacturer. And in many settings, in most settings, that power relationship is a little more equitable and that there's a little more negotiation. I had somebody I talked to who didn't want to be quoted, and so his story didn't end up in the book, but he worked for Kraft, and he was at one point in charge of a line of barbecue sauce for Kraft. And I said, well, how does pricing work? He said, well, you know, summer season's the big season for barbecue sauce. We go to Bentonville in January, February, and talk about our marketing program for this summer for barbecue sauce. And, you know, we'll say to them, so this is what we're going to do. This is the cool display with the little cardboard cutout of the grill and so forth and so on. And here's the new label and so forth. And we're thinking 99 cents a bottle. And they're great about everything, and they just look you right in the eye and say, 79 cents a bottle. And I said, okay, and what happens then? You say, what a great idea, 79 cents a bottle. I'm sorry, I didn't think of it myself. And that's the end of the conversation. Well, that doesn't sound like the market for barbecue sauce determining the price through the normal feedback loop of supply and demand. Yes, if you take a lawn sprinkler and cut the price from $6.97 to $1.97, people will buy lawn sprinklers. But why did you cut the price? Did you cut the price because you needed to sell them, because people needed to buy them, or because somebody with the power to impose a new price on the market ordered the new price imposed?
That's very interesting.
I think that's a slightly different twist on market capitalism.
Yeah, so it becomes once removed. And what happens is that demand becomes more indirect, I suppose, because Walmart has, you say that Walmart has the power. That's certainly true. It has that power because it has that large, loyal consumer base. And so I suppose, that's true. The normal mechanisms aren't working. It's once removed from the demand from the customer to Walmart.
That is the feedback loop. The feedback loop becomes, oh, it's all cheap. Let's go to Walmart. Let's tell the David. Can we tell the pickle story, the Vlasic pickle
story?
Yeah,
sure. Yes, so, dude, tell that. Tell the pickle story.
So Vlasic, I don't know if they still are, but in the late 90s and early 00s, they were the number one seller of pickles in America. They were doing 25% to 30% of their business at Walmart, and they have a whole range of products, as anybody who ever looks in the pickle aisle knows, and a buyer of pickles for Walmart, somebody whose job is to buy pickles and relishes and dressings and so forth, saw a product of Vlasic's that was a gallon jar of pickles. A gallon jar of pickles stands, you know, more than a foot tall. It weighs 12 or 13 pounds. And it's whole dill pickles. And this was really what they considered to be an item that they sold to small cafes and diners and to people having a special event, a company cookout or something. It's not a mainstream product. It's 12 pounds of whole pickles in the juice. And the buyer thought, this is really cool. This is kind of this is sort of what Walmart's about. Lots of pickles in the jar. And started talking to Vlasic, the Vlasic rep, for Walmart about the gallon, and they did an experiment in some stores, and they priced it at $3.49 a gallon. Well, $3.49 for a gallon of pickles is an amazing deal. A quart of pickles, you know, a quarter or an eighth that size, sells for $3.49 today, even. And it did very well. The gallon did very well. And then there was this sort of conversation between Walmart and Vlasic, and Walmart really wanted to sell the gallon in a big way. They wanted to price it below $3. They wanted to make it a real statement item. Here's what Walmart's about. And they settled on $2.97 a gallon for a gallon of pickles, cheaper than a quart. Now, you know, you can stop right here and say, well, what the heck was Vlasic doing? Why did they say yes? Well, Vlasic was trying to accommodate their largest customer. You just sort of chuckle and say, the gallon? I mean, no one's even going to want to lift it up and put it in their cart. If you want to sell the gallon, let's see how it does. So they put the gallon on pallets near the front in the sort of busiest part of the store. And as soon as it goes on sale for $2.97 a gallon, it's flying out the door. They're selling 80,000 gallons of pickles a week just at Walmart, just in gallon jars. And nobody's making any money on the gallon. Walmart and Vlasic together weren't making a penny each on the jar. And what rapidly happened was that Vlasic's other pickle business, Spears and the chips and so forth, they could literally look at data and see it falling off. People were buying the gallon jar of pickles at Walmart, and they stopped buying other kinds of pickles at regular grocery stores. It cannibalized their whole business. And after a few months of watching this happen, they're frantically scrambling deeper and deeper south into Mexico and Central America to supply whole dill pickles, whole dill cucumbers for the pickles. This was sort of a, you know, here's what's left in the field, let's put them in a gallon and sell them. Now it's become a mainline product. Completely redid their manufacturing, their sourcing and acquisition. They went to Walmart and they said, you know, this is killing us. This isn't a real product. It's a novelty product. It's chewing up the rest of our business. It's so cheap that we're losing our shirts. It can't be important to you. It's just pickles. Could we take the price up to $3.49? That would help us tremendously. And Walmart said, you're free to price it where you want, but this is doing such volume that we're going to have a $2.97 gallon of pickles. So if you can't deliver it, your pickle competitors, Mount Olive and the others, are waiting to supply us with this product. And, of course, everybody knows you're not making any money on the gallon, so if we take their gallon, we're going to kick you off the shelves for the Spears and the chips and the slices. And so they basically said to Vlasic, you can pull the gallon if you want. You can price it higher if you want, but we will pull all your products off our shelves. They didn't say it quite that way. And so Vlasic was literally held hostage by Walmart, because Walmart wanted the gallon. No one in America wanted a gallon jar of pickles as an ordinary consumer. There was no huge demand. There was not a flood of cucumbers driving the price of pickles down. This was pure marketing on the part of Walmart and the power to hold a supplier's business hostage. The interesting punchline is that Walmart talks publicly all the time about how it has a partnership with its suppliers, who really wants a good relationship for both them and Walmart and consumers. But in fact, within months of Walmart finally relenting and letting the price go up on the gallon, Vlasic filed for bankruptcy. The $2.97 gallon of pickles was not the only reason, but Walmart knew exactly what the financial status of Vlasic was. And there was no partnership involved here. There was no good news for both sides. It was all Walmart. I don't think that, to me, that's not that's not market capitalism. That's sort of Walmart imposing its will, and you don't need to have gracious and courteous and partnership relationships with your supplier, but if you talk about it, then you should, and Walmart's always talking about what a great relationship it has with its suppliers, and that's a perfect example of the kind of thing that goes on every day that isn't a partnership.
We've just got about 15 minutes left, and hope the caller will forgive me. He raised some good questions, but I would like to go on and try to get some other folks in, and some,
sure,
in fact, have been waiting for a while. Just real quick, also, let me introduce again our guest, Charles Fishman. He's a senior editor at Fast Company. It's a business magazine, and he is the author of the book The Walmart Effect, which contains the story that you just heard about the pickles, and also about Snapper lawnmowers, and about a lot of other things. It's published by the Penguin Press. Let's go to line number two, someone on a cell phone. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Am I on?
Yes. Go ahead, please.
I have a question and then a follow-up question, so a quick focused answer would be appreciated. No filibustering, please.
Sure. Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Where did that $5 go after the consumer puts it back in his wallet because he bought a $1.97 sprinkler instead of a $6.97 sprinkler? What happens to that $5?
That's a great question. I don't know. It may well get spent at Walmart. That would be my guess.
Yes, you do know. It gets spent. It's a consumer. They don't save. They just spend. Right?
I would guess. You don't always know the answer to that question, but that's a reasonable assumption, sure.
Well, of course. I want you to think about that, and then maybe on some other guest time have a longer answer. But second question is, what's your prescription? And I have an answer that I'd like to ask, but I'd like a quick, focused answer on that also. Well, and I haven't read your book. Just tell me, what's your prescription?
My prescription is very simple. I think we need more information about Walmart and about all companies that are as large as Walmart. We don't understand the impact of these companies. And the first thing I would do would be to sit down and say, these companies are different. Their fundamental nature is different from companies of 30 years ago or 50 years ago when the SEC rules and the disclosure rules were written. And we need a lot more information without damaging their competitiveness about them and all their peers, how they operate and what their impact is. Once you know what Walmart's effect on the cost of public health care is, how many Walmart associates get their health care through public welfare benefits. Once you know the answers to questions like that, then you may or may not change how you manage Walmart. But Walmart's not going anywhere, and I don't think Walmart should go anywhere. Walmart does incredible good for this country. But just like the car, if you think about the car, is the car good for America or bad for America? It's both. But we try and enhance the good things and manage and reduce the impact of the negative things. That's why we have seatbelts and zoning laws and airbags.
If I can interject a moment,
sure.
The analogy is apt as to the car. I will tell you, I'm a guy who has voted Democratic all my life. I've never voted for a Republican, and I never will. The problem, though, is there are too many feeble-minded analysts who aren't really asking all the right questions, such as, where did that other $5 go? Well, it gets spent, too, with some other consumer item, which may or may not be produced in China. The fact is, China doesn't just produce for Walmart. They produce for Monsanto. They produce for all of the large manufacturers, and it's not just a degrading of quality. Their quality, in many cases, matches what U.S. goods are. So I think the solution is not to try to block them, but to simply say, you can have access to our markets, but you have to provide the same thing our manufacturers provide for your employees, and that is health care,
safety rules,
pension plan, and if you don't do that, then we won't let you have access to our market.
I'm with you. If you leveled the playing field, we wouldn't have any trouble competing, and I'm not for walling off the nation by any means.
I'm not either. I think we have to let them in, but we'll just say you have to have a level playing field. You have to have certification from our inspectors from the United States that confirm that you are, in fact, satisfying environmental issues, satisfying health issues, and satisfying pension things. And then welcome aboard. If you're more efficient, you're welcome to our business.
Good point.
Anyway, that's that. I hope that more serious thought is given to that.
Well, that's the goal of the book is to change the conversation about Walmart from a shouting match to something that's a little more like an informed conversation.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else here. We'll go to Chicago for another caller. This is line number four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Before I get to my point, let me interject one thing that you brought up, the business of Timex. My father used to buy pocket watches from Ingersoll, which was in Connecticut. I think it later turned into the Timex Corporation. But he He had a pocket watch which wore down, and he sent the thing to the factory in Connecticut. He got back for repair. He got back two Ingersoll pocket watches.
Well, good for them.
Now, my point is that the system that Walmart has is essentially the same system that Rockefeller and his Standard Oil of New Jersey had 100 years ago, and it eventually his operations essentially ended up in the breakup of Standard Oil of New Jersey.
Right. There's an important distinction. I think the comparison is useful because the conversation 100 years ago about U.S. Steel and Standard Oil was about the dawn of a new kind of company. People looked around and realized that Standard Oil was not like anything that had come before and needed to be handled differently. The difference is this. Standard Oil was a supplier. They were a monopolist. They controlled the supply of oil. Walmart isn't a monopoly, and Walmart really does deploy its enormous power on behalf of consumers. So it would be hard to argue that Walmart's hurting ordinary people in the immediate sense at the shelf the way that it was easy to explain how Standard Oil and U.S. Steel were hurting ordinary people. That's why I think it's important to compare the eras, but the comparison ends with Walmart is a new kind of company, and it requires a new approach and a new way of thinking, not Walmart is a monopoly, because it's not a monopoly and it doesn't deploy its power to hurt consumers, at least in the short term. We do need to think about it differently and understand it much more thoroughly so that we can figure out a way to manage it effectively.
Well, essentially, they're using their power, their purchasing power, to force their suppliers to lower their prices. And essentially, what Standard of New Jersey did was they forced the railroads and Union Tank Car to lower their prices to transport the oil. Now, let me make one other point, and this is that the other businessmen essentially are trapped by their own stupid ideologies. What they need is to go to government, which they detest, and ask for help there, and, of course, get public backing in back of them, but essentially the government, and this may be a way out. The whole business of free trade is nothing but a trap for the United States, and it's a way down to the bottom.
All right. Well, I appreciate your thoughts.
All right. Well, let's talk with somebody else here. At least get one more caller. And I believe that would be in Champaign and line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling about two points here that your conversation really segue into my thinking here. On the first one is an internal or personal thing that has to do with the consumer, where it's not only as consumers and what it's doing to us as we go to the shelf, but as citizens. And we're hearing things from the Supreme Court now about spying and everything, and I think history bears out the fact that if we become lazy in our sensibilities, whether it's consuming or otherwise, there are other implications that change the face of the republic. And I'm concerned about that. I'd just like to know if you thought beyond the economic pattern about what Walmart's doing to us, or what we're allowing and what we're enjoying doing at great cost to ourselves on another plane as well. I'm concerned about that. The second point is an economic one, even though I'm not an economist. Isn't this kind of a house of cards if we're dependent on a variety of foreign sources to have this orchestrated supply of goods coming into this country? We're subject to the political well-being of all these other countries to keep this orchestrated consumer culture going. I'd like your comments on those two things.
Well, those are big topics. They may even each be a book in themselves. I try and touch on what the larger issues in Walmart's impact on sort of the American culture and the American character are. But I think before we go there, we actually need to tease out the very specific impacts Walmart has on the quality of products, the wages in the marketplace for factory workers and ordinary people. I do think that Walmart sort of exacerbates our tendency to want things to want the best price without actually quite understanding whether we're getting the best deal or not. And I'm sorry, I lost track of your second question. What was it?
Well, I'm afraid the caller rang off.
He's gone. Okay, I apologize.
In any case, we're at the point where we're going to have to stop, and I'm really sorry. I'm sure we could go at least another hour, if not further. And what's the last thought you'd like to leave people with?
Well, I guess I would come back to one point that we made briefly, which is I think Walmart is good for America and is bad for America. Walmart has changed the way goods are made in terms of efficiency in hugely beneficial ways. If you live on a modest income, Walmart is one of your best friends financially. But Walmart, it is okay to acknowledge the good and then go look at the bad, just like with the car. Cars are great. They're better with airbags. Cars are great, but we still need zoning to help shape roadways and have communities where the cars don't simply destroy the landscape. Walmart does many things that are great. That doesn't mean that we give up the right as citizens and as a country to manage Walmart's impact in all kinds of other arenas. And the first step to managing that impact is information. And Walmart is one of the most secretive companies in history. Yeah. And we need to demand of Walmart and of companies of Walmart's scale a whole fresh wave of information about their impact on a regular basis. And then we can say, as we do with, you know, insisting on seatbelts and airbags, here's some measures that mega corporations need to take in order to both continue to thrive and reduce the negative effects of the way they behave.
All right. The book is The Walmart Effect by our guest, Charles Fishman, senior editor at Fast Company magazine. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. And what great, smart listeners you have. Great question.
Thank you.